The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers.
And by Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Erica Janik. Every March, in towns across New Hampshire, citizens gather to vote on a year's worth of town business at town meeting. But where did this institution come from, and how does it work? We're digging into town meeting in the latest story from Civics 101, New Hampshire.
Maybe you're a Gilmore Girls fan, and if you aren't, I don't blame you. The hit TV show centers on the life of a mom and her daughter in small-town Connecticut. And like in a lot of small New England towns, there are these things called town meetings.
Grandfathering in previously proposed statutes with no procedural delay.
People get together, talk about the local issues, vote on them.
Say aye. All those opposed? People, what's going on? People!
Oh, sorry, Taylor.
So is that what town meeting is like in New Hampshire?
No, that is, I think, a very sort of comical representation of really a very serious and important event in a town where, you know, the voters have this opportunity to be part of the process.
In conjunction with the Board of Selectmen and then with information provided to the Budget Committee.
Or do you want a hotel or rooming house? I'm not sure. I didn't think that's what we wanted.
Welcome to Civics 101 New Hampshire. Today on the show, Daniela Ali peels back some of the layers of this venerated New Hampshire institution, town meeting. How did it start? How does it work? And in today's era, how are people participating in their communities?
So it's interesting because people usually think of town meetings as this very democratic institution.
You know, town meetings are direct democracy. The people make the decisions, y'all. You and your neighbors in a school gym voting on the budget and other town ordinances. In fact, in New Hampshire, the law says that at these meetings, citizens are the legislators.
But its origins are actually theocratic, meaning a rule by a religion or a religious group.
That's Tricia Peon. She's a New Hampshire historian and program manager at New Hampshire Humanities. Remember the Puritans? They were the folks who left England in search of religious freedom, eventually colonized Massachusetts, and made their way up to New Hampshire.
The point of it was to have a group of Congregationalists, so that's the Puritan church, so the members of the congregation, people who are in good spiritual standing with the church, making all of the decisions for the community.
In the Church of England, decisions were made only by the hierarchy of bishops and priests under the king. And the Puritans wanted something radical. They wanted a say in how their church worked. That was the main reason why they had sailed all the way to the New World. Once they made it across the Atlantic, it wasn't exactly a utopia of equality. The decision makers in the Puritan church were men. Only men. Land-owning men.
So they take that church model, the congregational church model of church government, and they apply that to town government.
These land-owning men would get together pretty frequently to make decisions for the town, around how to divide up the land, how much to pay in taxes to the church to support the minister. And back in the 17th century, who to allow into the town? Because they would want to know, is this person someone who regularly attends church? Are they in good spiritual standing? Are they cool like us? And some of the positions we have today in New Hampshire, like the select board or the executive branch of a town, go all the way back to the 17th century.
The highest ranking people in the town, people with the most wealth and status, would likely be the selectmen.
There were other jobs besides the selectmen that people ran for.
You know, like the hog reeve and like the guy who has to check every fence in the town. Some towns would have a position where someone was required to just, you know, basically catch all the animals that got loose. And that person would be elected every year.
Dumbarton still has this position, and former Governor John Sununu held it back in 2007. Town meeting has evolved since then. It became more democratic as other groups were allowed to participate, slowly. White men without property, women after 1920, people of color. Back in the 17th and 18th centuries, enslaved people would hold their own form of town meeting, electing black kings or governors for their own community on the same day all the white men had their elections. And nowadays, it's not just when the good old church boys want to get together that a town meeting happens. To start, town meeting is once a year. It's been that way since the 19th century. And to make sure it all happens, you need a town moderator, a select board, warrant articles, a spot for the registered voters in the town to get together. Usually that happens in a school gym.
You're a town moderator. We have a bunch of things to go through today, and not least of which the first 10 articles will be strictly voted on by ballot.
This is from a live stream of Kingston, New Hampshire's deliberative session of their town meeting a few weeks ago. At the back of the gym, there's this long table and a projector screen in the background. Sitting around the table are men and women, mostly middle-aged. A couple of guys are sporting Patriots jerseys. And one woman commands the room's attention. She is the town moderator. This is the elected official in charge of the town's election process. Their role on town meeting day? Manage the meeting, set the rules for the session, for example, how long a voter gets to speak, and even diffusing any tense moments.
We remind people at the beginning of the meeting that we are neighbors. We will be neighbors tomorrow.
This is Harold Bragg, town moderator of Kensington, New Hampshire. He's been in that role for about 9 years and town government for about 40. Like the Kingston town moderator, Harold reads each warrant article to the voters. These warrant articles are the agenda for town meeting.
The warrant, the reason it's called a warrant is because it is actually supposed to be a warning to the voters of the subject matter that's going to be discussed and deliberated and ultimately voted on at the town meeting.
That's Margaret Burns again, director of the New Hampshire Municipal Association. There are two ways you can get something on the agenda. The select board, which again is the executive arm of town government, decides what'll be a warrant article, say buying a new fire truck.
But the other way that articles get on the warrant is through petitioned warrant articles. And in fact, the voters have the ability to garner a certain number of signatures and to require an article to be placed on the warrant, one that the selectmen may or may not be, you know, in favor of.
Before town meeting, Harold gets together with Kensington's select board to talk about the warrant articles.
I always ask them if they feel, based on their meetings, if anything that they're proposing is contentious.
Town moderators can choose to go to annual workshops put on by the New Hampshire Municipal Association.
Then we're also sort of providing general guidance on good practices with regulating town meeting, rules of procedure, sort of things they have to anticipate or be ready for at town meeting, because that's a big part of it for a moderator, you know, being ready, you know, expect the unexpected.
Town meeting is a public forum. The people speak their minds about the issues at hand, zoning ordinances, noise ordinances, creating a town heritage commission.
The other areas that I spend some time on in the training programs is dealing with the First Amendment.
This is Stephen Buckley, Legal Services Counsel at the New Hampshire Municipal Association.
Because the First Amendment applies to town meeting. How does town meeting cope with those who wish to express their views? They could be voters or non-voters. Can they wear T-shirts expressing an opinion on a particular article?
Yes, they can.
Can they hand out flyers?
Yes.
And what is the relationship between those who are attending who are non-residents?
The moderator does place some rules on what folks can say, especially when it comes to speech that might disrupt the meeting. Someone saying the same thing over and over again, or threatening folks with physical violence. Both of those are big no's. It's a balancing act for moderators. Let everyone have a fair chance to speak their mind and get through all of the warrant articles. The central tenet of town meeting is that the voters are the legislators in their town. And that legislating power comes in the form of amendments. So someone can propose a change to a warrant article. Let's say there's an article that says, are you in favor of allotting $200,000 for road reconstruction?
The debate goes on at the meeting, and there are people who say, I don't think that we ought to be spending that kind of money on the roads. And there are those who say, I think we should be spending more money on the roads.
Let's say the person who doesn't want to spend the money on the roads, like really, really does not want to spend this money, gets up, waits their turn in line to talk, and says,
I am proposing an amendment that the Warren article read that the town, are you in favor of spending $0 for road reconstruction in the community?
Someone seconds the amendment proposed by Mr. If It Ain't Broke, Don't Fix It. And then the amendment goes to a vote.
If the room supports it, then the amount is zero.
And that's the final version of a Warren article that's voted on.
Again, it's the New Hampshire tradition of the people have the last word.
While this form of local governing has been lauded as the lifeblood of civic participation in New England, that this is what democracy is all about, participation in town meeting actually started to decline by the end of the 20th century. Because traditional town meeting is a long affair, sometimes going on until midnight on a weeknight or for most of a Saturday. The Warren articles are read, people debate, propose amendments to those articles, and on that same day, vote.
People are leading busier lives, and they're less inclined, perhaps, to do these kind of things that build in their relationship with their community. Because you go to a town meeting, you're going to get to know your neighbors, you're going to get to know what's going on in your town, and you can feel a part of what's going on in your community when you do that kind of thing.
On the other hand, some towns were also growing a lot, and not everyone could fit into the school gym. So in 1995, the New Hampshire legislature decided there could be another form of town meeting. It would split up the two major parts of town meeting, the debating or deliberation and the voting, to two different days. This is a Senate Bill 2 model, or for shorthand, SB2. The deliberative session takes place about 3 weeks before ballots are cast. About 72 of New Hampshire towns use the two-day model. Other New Hampshire towns either follow the traditional town meeting structure, everything happens on one day, or have gone to a town council format, which means those towns don't have a town meeting. Instead, there are elected town representatives who make the decisions, which is sort of like a city council. Some say even with this new format, the turnout at the deliberative session is still pretty low, and that can lend itself to interest groups in town getting more of a say than other folks.
There are always going to be interest groups, and those interest groups will drive the people who are connected to that group to come to the town meeting. So if you're a strong supporter of the library, you're going to come out and support the library budget. Some towns have a great deal of social capital.
Which means?
Where there's a lot of interaction, there's a lot of participation, there's a lot of contact with the schools and committees and organizations in the town. So it's town by town.
The town and the townspeople are not all powerful, and they've never existed in a vacuum.
Each town meeting really had its own its authority from the colonial legislature. So in New Hampshire, it's the General Assembly.
This is historian Tricia Peon again. So the towns had to share some power with the General Assembly. Those lawmakers would give towns instructions.
Towns were also very jealous of their rights. They guarded them very carefully. So towns would actually rise up against, you know, the royal authority or against the state authority or the colonial authority of the assemblies anytime they felt like their rights were being usurped.
That tension between towns and the man still exists today. And while towns have control over a lot of what happens within their town boundaries,
we're a state where towns can only enact ordinances or laws that relate to very specific subjects.
This is Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, a nonpartisan nonprofit group. And here's the law that spells out what's under a town's control.
Chapter 31, Powers and Duties of Towns. So this has a list of things that they are allowed to operate. So noise regulations, the observance of Memorial Day, regulation of the use of mufflers upon boats and vessels, fires, you know, kindling, when people can use fires, operations of vehicles on different roads. So, for example, you know, you can't go certain speed limits or you can't drive here or what have you.
All that to say, towns have to look to state law to give them the authority to do things. Other states have something called home rule, where towns are given a direct grant of power to govern themselves. But in New Hampshire, there is no home rule. It isn't a free-for-all. Here's Margaret Burns again.
even a town meeting, even that local democracy, they can only pass bylaws and ordinances and other things that state law says a town can pass.
So things like zoning ordinances, noise ordinances, the town budget and school budget, raising local taxes, salaries for town employees, and voting for local officials like the town clerk or town moderator, the select board. A few things towns can't do. They can't impose term limits, indoor smoking regulations that are stricter than state law, or implement rent control. And remember how Margaret basically said that these meetings are no laughing matter? Here is the perfect example of how dead serious citizens take them.
Millions of people are bracing, and they are bundling up as the third nor'easter in 2 weeks pummels the Northeast. Right now, Boston really getting the brunt of the
bitter. In 2018, when a nor'easter hit, some folks cross-country skied to cast their ballots. 2017 also saw a huge snowstorm. And that year, while some folks braved the weather, about 70 towns decided to postpone the town election. That led to the question, do towns have the power to reschedule town meeting? The Secretary of State, who's in charge of elections, said no, towns don't have that power. The whole issue is ongoing and still unresolved. And at this point, most folks are crossing their fingers for good weather this year. Some of this might sound intimidating, and Margaret says that's one reason people give for not going to the deliberative session. But towns usually put out voter guides on their websites, breaking down what's on the warrant, and the warrant's also available online. Here's Stephen Buckley's suggestion.
Get the town report and read it. Every town must publish, which has a wealth of information, financial data, reports from every board and commission, all kinds of information from the town clerk and statistics that is invaluable.
Yes, Mrs. Hart.
Folks know that the fire department has been working on this.
Has been sponsoring warrant articles.
The good news is it's under control. It's nothing compared to what a takeover would be like.
It's a lot of work to do this. We understand that setting up the procedures and our policies is going to be a huge amount of work.
At their heart, town meetings allow average non-elected folks, like you and me, to make decisions that shape the laws we follow, just like the Puritans wanted, and as memorialized in the Gilmore Girls' comical representations of town meetings.
It's not good, right?
All right, everybody who agrees that we would not feel good about that, say aye.
Aye!
Meeting adjourned. Good night.
Another fun one!
That story was produced by Daniela Ellie, with help from Jackie Hilbert and Ben Henry. Civics 101 New Hampshire is brought to you in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Up next, a story from Outside In on pirate trails. What's that, you ask? Well, Sam Evans Brown has the story.
In a surprise twist, we're going to start this episode walking through the woods. This is something called the Smarts Brook Trail System in the White Mountain National Forest in New Hampshire, so federal property. And we're walking on some trails that are not exactly legal.
A trail going up this way.
Oh, yeah. Pretty defined. I mean, these are not the stealthiest of stealth trails.
No.
And this one that we're on is, like, how many miles of trails are there here?
There's about 17 miles on the ground right now.
Our tour guide to these not entirely above board trails is Jody Chinchin.
District Trails Manager on the Pemigewasset Ranger District.
Jody has been a forest ranger, a trail builder, and a wildlands firefighter. She manages 600 miles of mostly hiking and snowmobiling trails. But these days, she's been spending a lot of time with mountain bikers.
And mountain bikers are obviously a biggie. They do a lot of work. They have a lot of energy, so.
Jody is, as far as I can tell, a model federal employee. Polite, accurate, and circumspect. She calls these trails incidental trails, user-created trails, non-network trails. Bureaucratic euphemisms for what they really are. Trails that got built on federal land without permission. She estimates there are about 35 or 40 miles of them just in her district of the National Forest.
So strictly speaking, it's not okay to just go dig a trail. but people have done it, mm-hmm. and that's a fairly common challenge that you all deal with.
Yeah, pretty common.
Can we redo that part about whether it's authorized to build trail?
Also along for the walk, Evan Burks, a public affairs officer.
And when you say redo it, what about?
Well, you asked the question about is it essentially legal to go out there and put trails on the forest?
Right.
The answer is no.
Yeah. Jody's being very careful to not offend mountain bikers, and Evan is trying to help her. For years, mountain bikers have been kind of like the woodsy version of skateboarders in a city, using a landscape not built for them, carving their own paths into the hills. And that rogue culture, the very fact that it was illegal and secret, was part of the allure. But now, the Forest Service is trying to fold these pirate mountain bike trails into the official trail system. And the best people to help them do this are also the very people who built the off-the-map trails in the first place.
We're trying to harness the good energy of all these great people that want to do the right thing and they want to have great mountain biking trails. At the same time, we have to do it correctly and we have to follow the process.
This is like how, for years, city officials used to put up signs that said no skateboarding and would hassle the kids that scraped up the new granite steps in front of the courthouse. But eventually, they gave up and built the kids' skate park. But as Jody is showing me a trail that's been designated for a redesign so that it takes a more circuitous, erosion-friendly route down a hill and avoids an apple orchard that the wildlife likes, we notice that the flagging for the new trail has been pulled down off the trees. Someone is trying to sabotage Jody's work.
So there are some adversaries to this project that, you know, there's people who want this trail to remain low use and to remain intact, and they want to maintain the character of the network just as it is.
Are these people who you know by name? You've seen them at the public meetings, and you're pretty sure you could identify the opponents on site?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sure this wasn't part of the plan for our walkabout tour, and I'm sure that Jody and Evan will be annoyed that this is what I've chosen to focus on, but what I was glimpsing was a game of cat and mouse, of federal forest officials wagging their fingers and prodding bike clubs to follow the law with vague ultimatums, and mountain bikers doing what they've basically done for decades, ignoring them. What we were witnessing was the silent battle for the soul of a sport.
It takes a little bit of practice and, you know, scars.
You know, these were our woods and, you know, we went out and played in them.
Collarbones would break. And,
you know, everybody looked around like, holy cow, look at all these trails.
It's not that cool anymore to build trails on national forests without consent.
It keeps me up at night, to be honest. I do know it's coming to a head.
There's a large contingent of folks that made those trails, those older trails, and they could give a rat's ass if anybody else ever come rides them.
This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I am Sam Evans Brown. Pirate trails are everywhere. The pioneers of mountain biking built them on private land and public land and everything in between. They were built by riders just looking for a place to take their new bikes. And in the process, they simply appropriated land that they wanted for their trails. But today, there's money to be made on mountain bike trails. And so the sport is being pushed to go legit. But what happens when the evolution of a sport threatens the very thing that made it so attractive in the first place? The first thing that I need to cop to here is that I mountain bike. I got a bike about 2 years ago, and I will confess that I think it's an absolute blast. I can't remember the last time that I was so excited about learning a new sport. Ultimately, I am glad for trails to take my bike on, and I'm struggling with the knowledge of how many of these trails were built. And because my bent for understanding things is to look at their history, let me introduce you to two mountain bikers who have been around since the beginning of the sport. First is Dave Harkless, a bike shop owner in Littleton, New Hampshire.
I'm one of the guys in this town that makes this town fun to live in.
Dave is a connected figure in New England mountain biking. He's kind of an ambassador for the sport, maybe a little scruffy, but he tucks his t-shirt in.
As I've matured, shall we say, I try to stick to legit trails.
The second is Gardner Kellogg, a surveyor in the same town.
I'm 71 years old and have been doing this mountain biking for probably longer than I should have.
He bought one of the very first mass-produced mountain bikes back in the early 80s and has built a lot of trails in his day. And I think at the time, he saw this as a victimless crime.
Earlier on, there just weren't that many people riding and it didn't really matter that much.
So why did mountain bikers feel like they needed their own trails? Well, back in the beginning, they didn't have any.
Back in the mid-80s and early 90s, most of the trails were made by somebody else for something else. They were logging roads. They were footpaths, sometimes, well-trod animal tracks. And we just rode whatever we could.
And the roads were extensive enough that you could ride for a few hours and get tired and go home. It was just fun to ride a bike in the woods.
Was it challenging?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Dave and Gardner didn't quite admit this, but early mountain bikes sucked. They had no shocks. They had small tires compared to today's, so you felt every bump and your arms would go numb after a lot of riding. They had lousy brakes and funky geometry, so they didn't stop very well and it was really easy to fly over the handlebars. To ride a bike like that, you had to be pretty hardcore.
Like, even the racing back then, you would, race up an unmowed run on a ski hill and then come bombing down some work access road trying not to eat it the whole way.
Holy
I mean, I had to walk a few times. I mean, it's okay to walk.
When did things start to change? When did trails for mountain bikes start to get built?
Real trails? Legit trails?
Legit trails wouldn't appear for another decade or more. But my sense is that it didn't take long for pirate trails to pop up.
Mountain bikers were definitely considered, renegades.
Just like the early skateboarders who drained pools in the uninhabited second homes in their California neighborhoods, the early mountain bikers found a place to take their new rigs.
We just go into the woods and start clearing away to get from one point to another, by hook or by crook.
If you've ever been out walking and turned onto a trail that suddenly is just zigzagging, maze-like through the woods, winding crazily through the trees and doubling back on itself, that's a mountain bike trail. They are super frustrating to walk on because they take forever to get anywhere. Mountain bikers don't want views or destinations. They want corners and obstacles and downhills and to ride their bikes until they're tired and wind up back where they started. And they want it close to home, which means often these trails were built in whatever woods were nearest by, no matter whose they were.
A lot of landowners up here are absentee landowners. A lot of land is old land and old families, been handed down through generations. They don't necessarily live on their land. And then you also have state forests and national forests, too.
In this area, there are a lot of large tracks that aren't really supervised, and so it really isn't an issue, and people really don't mind.
Again, the victimless crime narrative. But some of these landowners didn't exactly see it as victimless.
Have you ever had the experience of a private landowner who didn't know there was a trail on their land finding you to talk to you about it? And what are those conversations like?
There have been conversations, and some are nicer than other conversations.
The early trails were called rake and ride trails. So you could literally build a trail with a rake and a pair of loppers and a handsaw.
As the sport got more popular in the 90s, there was suddenly a constituency for these trails, but it was very clubby. You learned about the trails through word of mouth, through group rides at bike shops. To get on the trails, you had to know a guy.
And the trick was to get the group rides to ride on those trails so they'd get worn in.
And because these trails were built by these same hardcore mountain bike dudes who'd been willing to ride up unmowed ski slopes and bomb down access roads, the trails were not for beginners.
And they were tight, they were twisty, they were extremely technical. You could have 24 inches between the trees. There's still some trails like that around here, and we call them skinnies.
Riding these lines is intense. You fall over, you crash, you hurt yourself.
And it can be extremely frustrating. If somebody's looking to get into riding, and this is their first experience, they're gonna have to be a very determined person to be successful. Send them up there and like, go ride our trails, they're really fun, they're really awesome. They come back bloody and pissed.
Generally speaking, this was the state of affairs for mountain biking back in the early 2000s. Pirate mountain bike trails snaked their way through many, many little patches of undeveloped land that abut the towns where riders live. And the people who rode them were the ones who were willing to risk riding on unmarked trails that are extremely difficult and might not be legal to use. Which is to say, mostly white guys. Good numbers are hard to find, but I've seen numbers that suggest 75% of American riders are dudes. A lot of these trails were built by experts who were looking for things that were fun and challenging for them, but are kind of horrendously difficult for new riders. And because they were built without permission, the people who built them wanted them to stay under the radar so that they wouldn't get kicked off. Just a path, a whisper wider than a deer run, specifically designed to be winding and treacherous. And no trail signs. Trail signs invite outsiders. Trail signs bring attention. No trail signs. So maybe you're asking, so what? Who cares if there are pirate trails? Well, let me tell you a story.
The story as I have it is that the rabbi and his wife came to take a walk up the hill. She didn't want to go. She stayed at the car.
This is Mark Taylor. He sounds like he's setting up a joke, but he's not. He worked for 20 years as a police officer in a town called Franconia. Mark told me about a search and rescue that happened in 2001 when a rabbi from Brooklyn named Abraham Auer came up to the White Mountains.
It's like a pretty well-defined trail. I mean, it's wide.
It's a fairly well-defined trail here, and so it basically forms a loop about a mile and a half all the way around.
Abraham's wife, Milka, waited for him, but then it started to get dark.
About 9 o'clock, his wife calls the police. My chief shows up, talks to her, calls Fish and Game out. They make a pass up through. They make a quick walk up through. They didn't find him. So they decided they would start to search the next morning. Rained all day. It wasn't a hard rain, but it was cold and it was damp. So it was really a tough day to be outside in the weather if you had to be out in the weather.
By noon the next day, it was clear that Abraham Auer was really, really lost.
Fish and Game did come back and they made a pass through and they searched this whole area. They had, I want to say there was probably 3 or 4 Fish and Game officers and a couple volunteers. Didn't find anything. And that evening, apparently, the New York governor called New Hampshire governor, who in turn called our colonel of state police and the major from Fish and Game and said, we need to do something about this.
Apparently, Abraham was kind of a big deal.
At some point in time, the Hasidic Jewish community came up from New York with their urban search and rescue people. They had a mobile command post, which was basically out of an old Greyhound bus. All of your radio communications, all of your telephone communications, and their own ambulance.
How many folks came up from New York?
I would say by the end of the third day, there was probably 300 or 400 people here.
That's bananas.
Yeah. We had enough people, so that's about a mile and a half, 2 miles down the hill, and at least another mile and a half back up to the interstate. And we could put one person every 300 feet so that they could face into the woods and call the guy's name. It was a little eerie because you could physically stand here and you could be in the woods just a few feet and you would hear, Abraham, Abraham, where are you?
Prior or since, have you ever seen anything like that?
No, not at all. Second day they retraced their steps, and then the second day they found an article of his clothing where they had been the previous day.
It was a vest.
So he was basically walking in circles at that point.
By the third day, the governor's resources had arrived. There were dozens of searchers from Fish and Game, local and state police, and the National Guard.
They had a Black Hawk helicopter out here searching the area. And again, for a Black Hawk to search, it's more or less hovering. and they're looking straight down in the woods. And we got a message that basically they saw something in the woods. They weren't sure what they were looking at. And the fish and game team went out to where the helicopter was, because again, you can look through the woods and see it. And that's when they found him. And he had passed away at some point in time, probably within the past 24 hours, just from the exposure. Where we found him is only now a few hundred yards, probably, from where the nearest backyard is.
How does somebody get lost on a trail like this? A one-mile loop, super wide, well-defined trail, the most touristy of tourist hikes. Maybe you've already guessed the answer.
You're right ahead of you here. A little bit of a trail.
Yeah.
Not much.
Yeah. But yeah, you can definitely see it.
But the mountain bikes use this.
How pirate trails in the White Mountains claimed a life after a break.
So I'm following something.
Before the break, we learned about a man from New York City who got lost while hiking on a short, easy tourist loop in the White Mountains. While his death got a lot of attention back in 2001, what went unreported at the time was that he got lost because he turned onto an unmarked mountain bike trail. Near the top of the hiking loop, at the intersection where Abraham Auer needed to take a left to get back to his car and to his wife, there was another trail to the right, a mountain bike trail over private land. It's a trail that a few years earlier had fallen out of use because the bikers had been kicked off after a rider swore at the landowner who was out walking his dog. They rerouted the trail to the north so that it came out on a local cross-country ski loop. But that required crossing a brook. And before long, there was a big rainstorm, and the ramshackle biker's bridge that they'd built got washed away, and the trail fell out of use.
That was a very rotten log. Just sank right into it like stepping into deep snow.
I tried to walk the path that the riders must have followed, but after a few hundred yards, I lost the trail. And soon, just like Abraham Auer, I wasn't sure if I was headed the right way. I kept bushwhacking, wanting to see how far Abraham would have had to have walked in one direction to get himself out of trouble. But after 20 minutes of tromping my way along with no trail, with the sun starting to dip out of sight behind the bowl of mountains that ringed the area.
Yeah, and it's funny, I've just started to get those twinges of like, I'm far enough off the trail here that I'm not 100% confident of my ability to make it back. Doesn't take long.
This particular wrong turn was a really strange one to make. When you're making a circle of all lefts, why would you go right? But Abraham Auer wasn't the only one to make this mistake.
We had, obviously, the rabbi has taken this trailhead improperly. We've had several different tourists that have taken this. We actually had a school group, and the teacher got off course and took the whole group. And I actually found them over on 141. I actually got to a point where I could look down in the ravine and I could hear them talking. It's like, come up to here.
At least in this one spot, it seems pretty clear that a trail sign would have been nice. And it's not just inexperienced hikers that get lost on pirate trails. When you see maps of them, they look like a plate of spaghetti. I routinely get lost on my local bike trails. And so do very accomplished adventurers, like Peter Frick Wright.
I'd gotten up early, and I was, like, still in my pajamas, just riding, and my dog was just, like, looking at me the whole time, just having none of it.
Friend of the podcast, host of the Outside podcast with Outside Magazine, a couple of years ago, Peter took a few days to get some writing done at a family cabin in central Oregon, abutting some federal land.
Like, we came all the way out to like my favorite place, we're in the woods, and you're just staring at this glowing rectangle.
So Peter put down his computer, gave in to his dog. It was drizzling, so he threw on some rain gear over his pajamas and started walking the logging roads that crisscrossed the forest. After a little while, he saw a brand new mountain bike trail. No signs, though.
And I was just like, well, this looks great. Like, let's go explore.
He followed the trail, came out on another logging road, thought he knew where he was, and started walking.
Just walking and walking. And after probably 3 miles, I was like, I wonder if I'm turned around here. But I've gone 4 miles, so I can't just like turn around and walk another 4 miles backwards. And kind of the long story short of it is I ended up walking 12 miles in the wrong direction.
In your pajamas.
In my pajamas, out of my wallet. Like, all I had was a leash and a dog.
A very excited dog.
He was so stoked. He was just like, this is the best. Like, I'm going to bother you every time you're working now.
Here's my question. Like, what would you have needed in order to have not had this happen to you?
Oh, it could have been like any of a lot of different things. Like a single like trail sign saying like this way back to the way you came, or if there had been a marking of some kind, I had no bearings at all.
All of these pirate trail networks might have remained more or less hidden, unmarked, largely unnoticed, basically forever. But things have been changing. The bikes have been getting better. Those rattly death traps with no shocks and bad brakes have been replaced by cushy, full-suspension party bikes that squish their way over obstacles without as much punishment on your body. That's what got me into the sport. And the new riders who were drawn in were suddenly able to find trails because of another change, this one quite sudden. Around 2010, people started to upload their rides to GPS smartphone apps, which made the ride data public. In particular, there's one app called Strava. Strava has even gone so far as to create a global heat map, which looks kind of like one of those pictures of Earth at night from space, except the lights, instead of being city lights, are all the places that people ride bikes, including all the places where there aren't supposed to be trails. Suddenly, everybody knows about all of those underground trail networks. It's like that high school party that gets too big, and so it gets busted by the cops.
As I understand it, what happened is some of the local folks in the White Mountain National Forest offices were retiring. So these young people were coming up through, and some of them were avid mountain bikers. And they also were technologically savvy.
Again, Dave Harkless, the bike shop owner in New Hampshire.
They brought up the heat map, and you know, everybody looked around like, holy cow, look at all these trails.
While reporting this story, I heard tales of a federal government that couldn't decide whether it wanted to encourage mountain biking or ban it. In the 90s, they made and distributed a map of illegal mountain bike trails on federal property, essentially advertising them. But I also heard about a couple of years where they were sending out forest rangers to camp out at trailheads, waiting for the riders to come back to their cars so they could hand out tickets. So the federal response has drifted with whoever's in charge. But now, for the first time, you could see all of the pirate trails at once. And I think it became clear that this problem wasn't going to go away. And also, around this same time, the commercial side of the sport has really started to explode.
It goes up right here. Wait. Yeah. Where's my bike?
These are a couple of the many, many, many GoPro videos that are available on YouTube of people riding in a place called Kingdom Trails in Burke, Vermont.
Kingdom Trails is 100 plus miles of amazing trails up in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont.
And this is Abby Long, executive director of the Kingdom Trails Association, a nonprofit that manages this trail network.
Our mission is to provide recreation, education opportunities by managing, maintaining, building trails for the health of our community and regional economy.
That sounds like it was verbatim from something.
What? I'm okay. That's from the heart.
What's happened in the intervening decades from when a bunch of dirtbag mountain bikers first started hacking illegal trails out of the woods that their neighbors owned through to today is that mountain biking has become big business. A study of the tourism to Kingdom Trails has estimated that they bring $10 million a year to this very rural area. And Burke, Vermont, is just one of dozens of towns that have parlayed their mountain bike trails into million-dollar tourist industries. Moab, Utah, Sedona, Arizona, Pisgah, North Carolina, Bend, Oregon. But public trail networks have to be legit.
They first went door-to-door, knocking and talking people, face-to-face. And those few landowners, those generous landowners, we're at 92 landowners, which is incredible.
If, in the 80s, mountain bikers were the equivalent of skateboarders riding in their neighbor's pool that they had pumped out when no one was home, in 2018, towns like Burke, Vermont are the towns that built the skate park. And not just any skate park, the best damn skate park in the Northeast.
It offers everything. So someone who's hardcore can go get that technical riding. Someone who wants to just learn can go on some really fun greens. And then kiddos can learn to mountain bike with their striders on our little baby pump tracks.
But even inside a success story like Kingdom Trails, there are tensions.
There's a lot of folks who don't want things to change. They want things to be exactly how they were, how they grew up, and what they love.
The popularity of the trails means they're crowded on weekends, which annoys local riders. And it's brought traffic to the village, which annoys local drivers.
It keeps me up at night, to be honest. I do know it's coming to a head.
Kingdom Trails saved the Burke area. I mean, Burke was a very depressed area. But I also have a bunch of friends that live up there. They don't ride on the weekends. You do get a pushback, like, we don't want to be another Kingdom Trails. We don't want it so busy here that, you know, that we can't go enjoy our trails ourselves. And I don't want that either. I personally take joy in seeing somebody, you know, like a guy and a family and his wife and kids out on our local trails having fun and smiling. I'll stop and shoot the breeze with them. And there's a large contingent of folks that have made those trails, those older trails, and they could give a rat's ass if anybody else ever come rides them. They do not care. They just want their trails.
When a sport is brand new and there's nowhere to do it, the few people who take it up tend to be the ones willing to bear the risk of using spaces where they're not allowed. This can make for skeletons in the closet, since the culture that forms as a result is one that is, in part, defined by being outsiders. Then, once the market sees an opportunity and starts to bring in the masses, when they build the proverbial skate park, the old guard, the original riders, sometimes don't like what they see. But time and technology marches on. And that's what's happening back at Smarts Brook, where we started this episode, and where Jody Chinchin is overseeing the proposed redesign of those pirate trails.
And I think all of these things have promoted a different type of an experience, you know, it's just kind of matured over the years, maybe. People are happier now with, you know, something that they can go home from with, you know, a little bit less blood at the end of the day, hopefully. Not no blood, but just a little bit.
Yeah.
If you remember, on our walk, we tried to follow their proposed trail redesign. This was where someone had torn down the flagging that showed where the trail would go. After a brief bushwhack, we popped back out of the woods.
Oh, we're back on the trail.
So this is interesting.
It's a trail that you didn't know about?
Mm-mm. And I don't remember this from 2 years ago, so yeah, but...
Happens fast. Yeah.
You can walk it out if you want.
Yeah. I'm psyched to explore a brand new pirate trail with you if you want to do that.
Let's just take it back to the orchard.
Okay.
You can build them a skate park, but at least for a little while, until the culture changes, some of those kids are still going to prefer to scrape up the courthouse steps.
Whoa! Whoa! Let's not
Whoa,
do that
Where'd
again.
The GoPro go?
You see it?
Stay still. Stay still. All right. Stay still. You've had a bit of a fall, but I'm here looking after you, all right? Okay.
You're going a bit too slowly over the jump. You hit your head, all right? You've been unconscious for quite a while, so we need to basically move your elbow out and make that impact, all right?
Outside In was produced this week by me, Sam Evans-Brown, and Taylor Quimby, with help from Justine Paradise, Jimmy Gutierrez, Nick Capodice, Ben Henry, Hannah McCarthy, Jason Moon, and Lauren Chulgin. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is director of piracy of all sorts. If you aren't already, you should be following us on the social medias. We are at Outside In Radio on Twitter, where we regularly tweet out threads full of extras from our reporting that didn't make it into the stories. And we have a closed, moderated, very friendly Facebook group. Just go and search for Outside/In and ask for permission to join. Music in this episode by Blue Dot Sessions, and our theme music is by Break Master Cylinder. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Yeah, you got a bit of a cut to your lip.
Yeah.
And a bit of a cut to your head.